It's my pleasure now to introduce Professor Philip Goh, Professor of Architecture here at the University of Melbourne. And Philip has experience overseas. He's been a visiting scholar at various institutions in the UK and the USA. And he's the former president of the Victorian chapter of the Royal Australian Institute of Architects. Philip's research focus is architectural history, theory and design, and he's an authority of Australian modern architecture and is well known for his expertise on the life and work of Robin Boyd, who we had reference to this morning. And Philip's lecture is entitled, I think quite timely for us all here, A Detailed Look and Conversation About the University of Melbourne's Heritage Landscapes. Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks, Corinne. So I'm afraid I've got a lot of images, so apologies. And I've called this brief presentation, it's meant to start a conversation, but to use the phrase ornamental private grounds, which was what the university was described by some commentators in the late 19th century. What I'm going to be talking about today is really the university as a series of layered landscapes, as in a landscape that's had extraordinary evolution. Many of those processes entirely unplanned, and I guess also to a series of failed master plans and an overlay over many, many decades. The lecture also owes a great debt to the late George Tibbetts, because it was his research which really has set the groundwork for much of the very good study that's been done ever since. And George was a founding member of the university's Heritage Committee, which I was on with, was chaired by Professor Evan Walker. And sadly, in the university's diminution of its administrative procedures, the university's Heritage Committee is now no more. That's as much as I diplomatically can say. But what I should start, though, is that the university landscape is one with a very long history. And we have to acknowledge that the landscape had been occupied by the Wurundjeri people and their clan head, Billy Billbury, for many, many decades before the university was actually founded. You can still see these fabulous River Red Gums close to the playing fields north of the Burrup Pier. It's interesting because the River Red Gums means that the site where we are actually has a lot of water, far more than most people actually imagine. And when the site was given, well, the university was given its grant in 1853, it's quite interesting because the idea of subdivision actually, I'll use the cursor, if that's right, the use of subdivision actually indicates some particular landscape features. Oh, great. So you see here, this is the original university grant. This is Grattan Street, Royal Parade, Swanson Street. The Teachers College got a little portion. This is Tin Alley, and this is the university boundary. And this is from George Tibbetts' early research. What's interesting is that both sites actually straddle or lie parallel to essentially what it was, a water course. So this is going to dictate some of the fundamental spatial arrangements that persist over many, many decades. So that by 1854, you get a sense of how these divisions are maintained. There's the original grant, which the university, in its wisdom, argued for expansion, and it did. So this was over towards the Teachers College, who still had some of their land. And this is the area where that watercourse was. And there was a swamp here. And right from the outset, there was a notion that there be a front of the campus facing the city and that there would be a back. So the wetland was at the back, as were the student lavatories, all the unseemly things at the back, and the front was where the university faced the city. And the first building, designed by F.M. White, was going to be this one, and even at this stage it was an idea of the building occupying, if you like, the highest part of the land to give a great prospect towards the city. The livestock, there was a little ha-ha running around the edge of this sort of flat terrace. And at this stage, the early planting was in a sort of garden-esque mode. And here's a colour lithograph to show you the sort of character. And at this stage, the university cleverly is occupying the centre of the site, and it's as if it's a castle in a park. And following very much the idea of sort of Oxbridge Tudor Gothic model in terms of the architecture. So this was the original front, and this was going to be the entrance, a picturesque castellated tower, which was never done. What we know, of course, is that this was the entry feature to the university for many years. The quadrangle was open to that south approach from Grattan Street, and the wings of the building on either side. And at the back of the old quadrangle building, the wetland was quickly converted into an ornamental lake. So here we're looking from the north, we're looking south-west, but northeast of the quadrangle building. So this is this wetland converted into an ornamental lake. And the quadrangle, though, was finally completed in 1970, when Ray Featherstone and Bergen Alexandra closed in that old quadrangle, the university's council room is above, and completed, if you like, the ideal version of the cloistered quadrangle, the great echo of Oxford and Cambridge. And meanwhile, the back of the old quadrangle building, which had been covered over by the old university book room, was actually in one of the university's great moves is to remove buildings to create space. And so here we see the Redenbaum's additions to the quadrangle buildings now revealed, and it's actually opened up a great space between the Union Building and the old quadrangle. So by 1856, some spatial arrangements started to really take place. The ornamental lake was there in a picturesque fashion, and then opposite, in a sort of scientific fashion, almost as if a sort of complete opposite, was this sort of encyclopedia of plants, as Anne said, a botanical garden. And Anne Neil tomorrow will give you a much more detailed history of the garden than I'm able to do. But look at the scale of it. And I guess the other thing is to think of it. This is a very large, if you like, scientific garden where students could learn. And there's a whole fashion now for object-based learning. Well, in this many respects, this is so that students could actually learn by seeing things, not be beholden to me in a lecture theatre as such, but to actually go out into the field. And at this stage too, then this back part of the university was devoted largely to these great landscape spaces. And the System Garden in 1856, although this is a slightly later photograph, is laid out on this Linnaean principle, this botanical gardens principle. By 1863, the National Museum had been built to the west of the ornamental lake, and so this is where the Union Building now sits. So there was a National Museum. So this is where essentially early Museum Victoria. And this is behind to the north of the old quadrangle building. So there starts to be a consolidation of buildings from that central old quadrangle building. And here you can see it in the 1950s where the lake has gone. But this is the National Museum where the Union Building is. Here you can see the additions that were started to be made in the 1930s. But essentially that was the landscape front looking across what we know as the concrete lawns. Interestingly too, the National Museum was, if you like, an internalised version of the Encyclopedia of the System Garden. Here you could go into the Encyclopedia of the Museum. Another example of object-based learning, which the university is returning to now with a building like Arts West. So in many respects, this encyclopedic collection of objects from natural history is the logical partner to the System Garden in terms of the teaching, ideas of the university at the time. Here's a later photograph of that National Museum. And these beams are still visible in above the Union Theatre. It's buried inside the Union Building. Very controversial because the Union Building is going to be removed in a few years. If we looked across the ornamental lake, there is the medical school. And what's interesting is that this is a formal, almost Palladian composition facing into the centre of the campus. So at this stage, most of the buildings are actually inward facing. And this is the northeast corner. This is where physics is today. But there was a reason, and George Tibbetts has argued wonderfully, that the reason that was the medical faculty was located in the far northeast corner was the issue of cadavers and dissection and possible smells and odours from the activities going on there. So what we're seeing here are buildings starting to be placed and border major pieces of landscape. Also, by 1875, the jewel in the crown, so to speak, of Wilson Hall is constructed right next to the old Quadrangle building. So here's the great drive upwards from Grattan Street, old Quadrangle building, and to its right, to the east, is Wilson Hall, one of the most accomplished Gothic Revival buildings in Melbourne, designed by Reed and Barnes, who also, at that stage, if you like, university architects. And what they build next in the 1880s is the new medical school, next to the old medical school, so facing across that giant landscape of the ornamental lake to the National Museum. So by 1896, the university has started to develop some intrinsic and important spaces. The Sistine Garden, by 1896, is still this huge scale. The professors' houses are here, and this is professors' walk. And there's one professor's house here, which is University House today. So these are major spaces. That walk and all the university's professors' houses face inwards. All their privies and their back gardens face Royal Parade. We've turned our back to the city, essentially. Because all at this stage, this is all market gardens and pig and sheep markets and like over here. Here's the medical faculty, at this stage a very large faculty, and its buildings facing the ornamental lake. There's the National Museum. The Teachers College starts, and all this is free space, and there's that axis up. This is Wilson Hall here, and this is old physics. And this is all relatively unplanned. What starts to happen, though, is with the addition of buildings, you start to get this idea of enclosed courtyard spaces that match the scale of the original centre of the campus. And unwittingly, it starts to develop, if you like, a language for the university generally in terms of outdoor landscapes. Oops, it's interesting. I've entirely lost an image. It's just disappeared. It was there a minute ago, but let's keep going. So this is this idea of the university campus in 1896, an image looking across the ornamental lake to Wilson Hall. And with the turn of the century, the university started to change somewhat. The first building to really face outwards to the city was the Conservatorium of Music, and started to face the newly planted Boulevard of Trees on Royal Parade. And by 1919, the university had changed still more. The colleges had started to consolidate, and here's Walter Burley Griffin and Marion Marnie's Newman College. Medical school is still there. Engineering starts to have a foothold in that spare space here. There's the division of the Teachers College, still a separate site. So the medical faculty, Baldwin Spencer, is being built by Reed and Barnes. These buildings facing, if you like, starting to enclose this big landscape. The Sistine Garden is still intact. There's the conservatorium. The professor's house is still there. The Gate Lodge is still there. But engineering is starting to become a force on campus. And this idea of precincts starts to occur. By the 1920s, particularly, there's a boom after building boom after World War I. All of a sudden, the university, what is interesting, the Sistine Garden is encroached upon. Yes. And look how much. This building is the key culprit, the Botany Building, and agriculture. So those two buildings, really built by the Public Works Department, are the major culprits to start a gradual encroachment on this space.
the ornamental lake has gone and Old Commerce is built between the medical school and the National Museum. Chemistry has been built, and also Old Arts, these two very large, basically teaching buildings. And what they start to do is they start to create two courtyards here, a courtyard between Old Quadrangle and the Wilson Hall, so these large outdoor rooms. The Professor's Walk now starts to get a sense of enclosure. There's still the big space in front, onto Grattan Street. The Vice Chancellor gets a house, and this area is still unbuilt on. And the university is still facing inward, with the exception of the Conservatory of Music and the Granger Museum.
And it's this really big building of Old Arts, where F.M. White's picturesque tower is finally achieved, but not on the Quadrangle building, but on Old Arts. And it's really this building, Old Arts, a huge teaching facility for the arts faculty, where the arts faculty now starts to gain in scale and influence on the university campus. And at this stage, still no overall master plan for the landscape. There's a war memorial on axis with the Old Quadrangle at this stage, and which has been moved a number of times over the years. But it's this building of Old Arts which gives the university today still its if you like, marketing pedigree. What happens though, oh, goodness me, I've just lost an image of Cassonia Court. This is very sad, this special computer, this one, because I had a very beautiful image of the Cassonia Court and old physics and the tree. Cassonia Court is wonderful because it's actually the site of a freshwater well, and it still remains and it's still open space. Let's hope I don't lose this one. So what I was going to show you was Cassonia Court in here, with the famous Cassonia tree. Here's botany, and here you can see how, there's the outline of the system garden, and how much botany encroached upon that circular plant. Here are the professors' houses. The Union built, here's the National Museum, starting to actually be eaten away by the Union Theatre, and the new Union building by Philip Hudson, who designed the Shrine of Remembrance. There's chemistry under construction, and here's Old Commerce. The ornamental lake is filled in. Here's Baldwin Spencer, here's Tin Alley. So the university's really consolidating. This is a time where students wore suits. There were one or two women in the image. And these are the buildings that the university actually is. There's Botany, the building that we're in at the moment, this new language for the campus. And by the 30s, that language is moving from red brick, collegiate, Gothic, to cream... I've lost cream brick, sorry. That was chemistry. The cream brick here, too, is visible, and the National Museum is going to be slowly eaten away. The Vice-Chancellor gets a new house. Care of Harry Norris and the Nicholas family, who gave much of the money, the Aspro millionaires... And I've lost that one too. And then there's war and the X-ray laboratory, which is now a building under threat. Great nuclear research done here. But the reason to skip over here is to show you that only in the late 1940s is a really distinctive master plan provided. The new Professor of Architecture, Brian Lewis, does a concept plan. And look what he does. He removes all the professors' houses. He creates a wall of high-rise buildings on Royal Parade, along Tin Alley, and also too. But he keeps the Old Quadrangle building, Old Arts, the Wilson Hall. He puts a high-rise building on axis behind the Old Quadrangle for administration in a high-rise tower. It's rather like London University. That's the model. And what we're going to see is this high-rise vision. None of this actually gets realised completely, but some key ideas do. What will happen is that the medical faculty will move from this corner to this corner. There'll be the sense of a series of slabs starting to be built on Royal Parade, and this idea of administration sitting in a high-rise tower, palazzos of power, will actually eventuate. So by 1952, This is another Brian Lewis master plan, a bizarre idea of not letting Tinelli go through. And all of this area, these are car parks, enormous car parks everywhere. And the key seed that is planted is the idea of moving the medical faculty over to this corner and starting a series of slab blocks. And it's a complete change, if you like, spatially, to these original spaces, which were about particular garden spaces. And at this stage, too, the Teachers' College is just considered as a sort of void in the planning program. What happens in 52, though, is there's a fire in Wilson Hall. The university is really grief-stricken because one of their most loved buildings goes. And there's great controversy over what should replace it, whether it should be reconstructed, restored. And in actual fact, the post-war growth of the university, and I've lost an, I can't believe this, another image of Wilson Hall, this one is here, where modernism actually wins the day. And the Gothic Revival building is replaced by this one, which then on the side plan, here it is, this is Wilson Hall, on the footprint of the old one, but larger, and the creation of Macfarlane Court here between chemistry and the old quad. And this computer has lost, sorry, I really do apologise, it's lost a very nice image of Macfarlane Court. It's making me hurry up, though. There are the slab blocks on the Brian Lewis master plan. And Bates McCutcheon do a plan for a series of slabs in the medical precinct. And an echo of the high-rise plan of Brian Lewis's, it appears with Redmond Barry and Raymond Priestley. So the administration of high-rise gets moved off axis from the old quadrangle building to sit between Macfarlane Court and the concrete lawn. And on Tin Alley, echoing Brian Lewis's master plan, is the high-rise building of the Redmond Barry building. In landscape terms, what happens is that John Stevens, the designer of the garden of ICI House, is commissioned to do the wonderful garden here of the Redmond Barry building to the north, a garden which in many respects has been rediscovered in recent years, particularly by Andrew Saniger. And also, the idea of the contemporary cloister starts to be reappreciated this time by the staff architect Ray Featherston. And this is an image of the opening of the garden by the building and the garden by Sir Henry Bolte. You can still see these giant rocks with a huge inscription of them, not nearly as sympathetic as Ella Stones's placement of rocks by any means. So the university in the 60s is filling in, and it fills in at Grattan Street with the building of the John Medley buildings by Roy Grounds. So the image on the right shows you looking from the old quadrangle back towards Grattan Street, and this is from the Grattan Street entrance, showing Grounds actually appreciating the idea of these being gateway buildings to the campus proper. By 1970, and I've lost Raymond Priestley, and I'll keep going. So Raymond Priestley introduced the idea of the contemporary cloister. So this is the old quad, Redmond Barry and Raymond Priestley. The 60s has seen, not seen, this is getting to be a bit of a nuisance, but by 1970, as Anne mentioned, there was the commissioning of a master plan by Ancart, Mortlock, Murray and Woolley. The key figure is, as Anne said, Bryce Mortlock, who examines the university at this stage and argues that the university has developed a coherent series of outdoor rooms. The proposal, though, is actually to consolidate this idea of outdoor rooms. The system garden was actually to be reconfigured entirely. The university was going to expand across into Carlton. This is Faraday Street, It doesn't look like that now. And Richard Berry was going to go, his architecture. So in principle, the idea was very interesting and respectful. It had borrowed much from research done in Cambridge by Lionel March and Leslie Martin. And the key project was this one, the South Lawn and Underground Car Park by Bryce Mortlock, the engineers Loder and Bailey, Raymond and Stones. And this is the Undercroft, and this is where the Alice Stones garden is here. This is with the Raymond and Stones landscape above. And the brilliant idea... Your computer over here in botany has just lost all of my... I've lost all of my wonderful colour images. I'm terribly sorry. At least the drawing has survived of the trees sitting in these wonderful hyperbolic paraboloid shells as giant pot plants, essentially. Union House replaces the National Museum. By 1974, Anker Mortlock and Murray and Woolley produced the Landscape Elements Report. And this is where the Clifton Grey bricks, or the tan bricks on the ground, actually is put into a formal report and becomes the language. And please, can Deacon Court stay on the screen? Yes, it has. I'll do a little silent prayer each time I press the button here. So what happens now is that all of a sudden, with this idea of a coherent landscape master plan, which is actually given coherence to the campus has a disparate set of architecturally disparate set of buildings, but the landscape has given it unity. And this is one of my favourite courts on campus, Deacon Court by Darrell Jackson and Evan Walker. And it's still today, I think, one of the campuses where actually it acknowledges, even in its pieces, the history of the campus. It includes the wonderful John Olson mural executed by Tom Sanders. Very few students realise that it's there. And we jump fast forward to the 1990s, where the university starts to face outwards again for the first time, with the Ian Potter Museum of Art, Sydney Meyer Asia Centre. And at last, by 2008, master plans are starting to come out on a regular basis. Having learnt from the Bryce Mortlock plan of 1970, the university has now started to understand itself as a series of outdoor rooms, and by 2014, its latest iteration with Peter Elliott, but also working with Taylor Cullity McLean, landscape architects. So that today, when we have a new building like Arts West, it acknowledges the tradition of the cloister, its new Indigenous garden is a great success, and the university can be seen as a succession of extraordinary landscapes, and finally, after nearly 150 years, in many respects, a coherent view to the future. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much, and I wouldn't worry about the few odd slides going. Oh. And it's not Botany's computer.
Right, sorry. Sorry.
That was an outstanding talk.
Oh, thanks.
We have time for a few questions, but I'll just let you know what's going to happen later. I've got some morning tea set up down outside G26, G27, walking down the corridor, where you can look into the system garden. Anyone who wants to go to the tree planting at 11:30 are welcome to go, otherwise you can just have more tea and coffee. And tea clock time, we are having two tours going on in parallel, one the herbarium and one the system garden, then swapping over if you'd like to join those tours, unless they're already booked out.
I think there's still room.
Okay, good. Excellent. So, questions?
I'm interested to know why it's called system. Never heard the term system garden, the first time I'm aware of it. Why system garden, the term?
I think we should ask Anne.
Oh, all right. Yes, principally it would be better as a botanist.
Right.
So the original idea that it would be, is taken from the word systematic, which is the classification of plants.
So the garden being laid out so that you would see plants that belong to a particular order of flowering plants or a particular class or family or genus. So scientifically, based on classification, I think that was the original idea of McCoy, who, by the sounds of the talk yesterday, wanted to have every plant in the world represented.
He really saw the circular layout as being a way, because it was like, you know, if you could draw a plan in the book that showed how all the orders, families, genuses related to one another, well, he planned to do it at a large scale over 4 acres on the ground.
Mm.
And because he was a geologist rather than a botanist, he wasn't too fussed whether it actually included plants or not. As long as all the labels were there, people could get the picture.
Anne's going to give a talk tomorrow.
All right.
If you'd like to come on.
Thank you very much. I keep learning. But may I raise just one more question?
Sure.
I have been in Melbourne 22 years, originally from Hong Kong. I become aware recently there were lots of weeds all over the nature strips in Melbourne. They look terrible. They are like cancer. They spread, you know, cover all the grass. It's a very bad sight to see all that.
Weeds.
Yeah, I just wonder, you know, learning from Melbourne University about this botanic issues. So what can people do about all this? You know, I'm actually volunteer myself just to deal with a patch of lawn in North Melbourne near my home. Keep plucking all those weeds.
I don't know that much about weeds.
Plant bricks on the top of them.
Right.
I think the real problem this year, I mean, it's an ongoing problem, but this year it's particularly difficult because of the immense amount of rain.
That's right.
And I think anybody who's seen the oxalis coming up, I just look at it and I think, you know, you can't get rid of them.
Yeah.
There's one, I was told once when I was doing garden writing by an old fellow, that there is a certain time of the year when you can stop oxalis, because at one time of the year, all those things that go out and have little bulbs at the end curl up, and that's when you dig them out.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that it used to be December, and I think it's gone back probably to October now, because everything's changing.
Yeah.
The council is trying to put steam, hot steam, for all the weed now. It'll be costing a lot, but they say that's the only way we can stop, because it's become too much in southeast of Melbourne now.
Mm-hmm.
So pesticides are not helping. So it's one thing that I would use. They were very bold to start now.
Thank you. Up there.
The campus site used to be enclosed by a fence, as was the exhibition building.
Yes.
My understanding is that the beautiful old fencing came down as part of an agreement with Melbourne City Council. The council would bear the costs of and look after the gardening on university campus, provided it was all open to the public. Can you explain where that fits in the timescale relation to the 1970 master plans?
My understanding was that the fence came down a long time before 1970. That much of it was removed during wartime, and it was not only the University of Melbourne's fence that came down, but many institutions' fences came down. So there are fragments of it left on Grattan Street. In many respects, it would have been a great thing to get back, but I'm not aware of the Melbourne City Council having responsibility for the grounds.
They did for a period. Maybe, I forget exactly, I think I've been in the 1930s, but I'm sorry.
Yeah.
38
to 68. Right.
But in view of seeing the grounds as a public park, that was the intention right
from
the
start.
Not the system garden, that was always purely for teaching purposes. But the idea was that for most people it was too big a walk to go from Carlton down to the Botanic Gardens for recreation. And so when the grounds were laid out, it was always an understanding of the grant from the government that the grounds were publicly accessible for public passive recreation.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Just one quick question, or two quick questions, and then we can keep talking when we go and have our cup of tea.
Just a question about the water. You said it used to be a water course here originally. Had the university built a underground water system to keep everything going?
Much of the water course is underground. Yeah. So there are substantial water courses underneath, as far as I'm concerned. Andrew, is that right? Yeah. And others? I mean, that there is actually a creek, if you like, running underneath part of the site towards the east of the campus.
Thank you.
You
have
a question?
Yes, I did want to ask about the, again, about the fence.
Yes.
It seems to be important as part of the more vertical delineation of parts. The blue stone footings foundation remain along Royal Parade. There still is, of course, a remnant from Goat Fort Gate to 13, is it?
That's right.
Along the way. And that seems to me a great deficiency of the present appearance of the university, and something needs to be done. Would it be a good idea for them to have a hedge, preferably a multi-species hedge, for the sake of biodiversity and all that sort of thing, the hedge on those parts where the footings remain, which is from omitting, of course, the outward-facing places like the Grange Museum and the Conservatory and the Grange Centre, other parts. Could there not be such a hedge put in down to the down to Grattan Street, and there is a bit of hedge there, and then along to the centre, about 175 centimetres, I suggest. Would that appeal to your...
look, I think it has some appeal to me, but not necessarily to the university. partly because the university has a policy of making its campus publicly accessible, and they talk a lot about porosity, of big students being able to come in at any point. And also to, I think, the southwest corner of the campus is there's going to be a big question mark, because I'm sure the medical faculty has big ambitions to jump Grattan Street and build afresh. So the future of the triradial building, that's the medical school, and the slabs to the north, I think, is under question. And added to that, what's going to happen with the underground railway station going in there eventually, I think there'll be a big change in that corner. But I think it's at some point the university has to remember that fragments that you suggest, like the bluestone foundations and the fence, should somehow be not recorded, but remain. And I think the idea that you can actually read the history of a university through physical elements is still very, very important. Whether it's a hedge, whether it's a reconstruction of the fence, I think at some point that idea of the university as an enclosed ornamental park is still an idea that should be held on to.
Yes, it was at 175 centimetres, because you could see over it, you could see across. It's not like some of the hedges they're putting up here as a Trinity.
No.
They're too high.
They're far too high. Yeah,
too dark.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you very much for your comment. Virginia, can I get you to let people down at 10 coffee for those of you who'd like to come? And Anne's going to be there. Phil, can you come in for coffee?
I will.
Yeah. So we can keep talking down there.